The TNT Shop has great gift ideas for your furry family member at TNTRadio.live. Perspective with Jesse Zurawell on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Perspective. I'm Jesse Zurawell, your host for the hour. Back with me today is Christine Massey. Christine is a former biostatistician who is based in the Toronto area, and she's been collecting freedom of information responses from around the world, along with several colleagues, which have shown that no one anywhere has a sample of the alleged SARS-CoV-2 virus, and hence no COVID-19 science exists or could exist. Christine, welcome back. Thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you, Jesse. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Toward the end of our last conversation on air, which was in late September, we brought up briefly, I believe, Paratech and the University of Sheffield and a test that the university and this corporation, Paratech Limited, have been developing for several years now. It's supposed to be a test that identifies whether or not somebody is quote unquote positive with the quote unquote SARS-CoV-2 virus. And at the head of this project is at the university is a man named Carl Smith. And we can talk about who he is. And I certainly want to talk about what's going on here and the freedom of information requests you've submitted to the university. But to start us off, how did you chance upon this, or did you chance upon this? How did this come onto your radar?
That's a good question, because I was actually thinking about that today, because this story, it actually traces back, to at least March of 2021, because this is when my freedom of information requests to that university started out. And I was specifically mentioning Carl Smith from the beginning, and I can't actually remember how it got started. And I believe it was because back then I was on Twitter and I was quite active, along with a handful of other people, you know, talking about the fact that the alleged virus hadn't been shown to exist. And so I believe that's how it got started, that I bumped heads with Carl back on Twitter. Somehow he got on my radar, but I don't think I was aware back then that he was developing this test. I might have, like I said, my memory is gone for that. But I did find out actually this year that he's, I definitely found out at that time that he's involved in this test.
Mm-hmm. So you wrote about this, I should point out, on your Substack, which is Christine Massey, FOIS.substack.com. And right. The first article, well, not the first article, I would say a major update to the first article in which you wrote about this, you published in mid-September, and it's titled Fake COVID Test Developers, Carl Smith, you of Sheffield Paratech Limited, and a virus in inverted commas, FOI. And a week ago, you published another installment on this titled University of Sheffield Protects Fake COVID Test Developers, Paratech Limited, and Carl Smith again. So to dig into this, let's start, if you don't mind, with the first article, or the first one I mentioned, from September of this year. And essentially, I want to ask you, what is going on here? What is Carl Smith? What are Carl Smith, the University of Sheffield with which he's affiliated, at which he teaches, and this company, Parade Tech Limited, what are they developing or what have they developed? Because if you look at Parade Tech's website, apparently this test has been developed, although it's unclear whether or not it's been rolled out, if it's being used. And what have you been trying to, what information have you been trying to obtain from the University of Sheffield with regard to the development of this test?
So when this all began, I've been asking them for records. It started out with me asking them for any record by anyone in the world wherein this alleged virus was actually found in the bodily fluid or tissue or excrement of any sick person and purified. And that's the same request that I've been sending to hundreds of different institutions around the world. And the reason for that, we've talked about it before, but for anyone who's new to the topic, it's because in order to verify the suspicion that there's a new virus, to actually carry out some science, you have to actually have the particle that you think might be a virus. So this is just the preliminary step. You just find a particle in sick people that you think might be causing their illness. And then from there, you would have to purify it. And then from there, you could sequence it and characterize it and carry out controlled experiments. So it's the same request I've been asking lots of institutions. Do you even have that initial step? Do you have a record of anyone in the world carrying out the initial step? So that was how it got started out. And I don't know if I just answered your question, but I do have information on that article that you mentioned from September 16th. And I haven't delved a whole lot into the details of his test. And we can't really because they're not releasing the information, as we'll get to. But what we do know, I did collect some bits and pieces that I found in the news about it. So, for example, you've been mentioning this company, Paratech. It's P-A-R-A-Y-T-E-C, Paratech. I presume that's how you pronounce it. Mm-hmm. And they're under, I guess, a parent corporation called Braveheart Investment Group. And according to news reports, it says they've completed proof of concept trials for a coronavirus test that it's developing with the University of Sheffield, and that is Carl Smith's university. So they said that following the achievement of proof of concept for the optical detection system on October 5th, the focus, and this is, I'm not sure which year this article was from. This could be going back a couple of years. They said the focus has been on proof of concept trials for the capture and signal generation modules for the test. So whatever, they're talking about some technicalities that they're moving along in the process of looking at this test that they're developing. And so
it was 2021. When they put out
was
that
it? Thank
press
you.
Release.
Okay, I didn't actually click on the link. So yeah, so that's going back. So I don't know exactly where they are in the process right now. So well, my focus
can add,
with that.
I can. Apologies for interrupting. Yes, yeah. I can add to that because if you go to the Paratech website, which is paratech.com/COVID-19-test. There's a page which describes the COVID-19 optical measurement test, and Paratech describes itself as a UK-based scientific instrument company which develops high-performance specialist detectors for the analytical and life sciences instrumentation market, which if you know anything about PCR, rapid antigen tests, and the rest of this sort of technology, and understand that there are no viruses, quote unquote, which they're actually detecting. We're talking about tracking and tracing technology. So a reason, even if you're not interested in the missing virus problem, to pay attention to this, because we're talking about technology that can be used to track and trace and do other things to people. And we should all be very, at least skeptical about that, if not highly concerned. The page goes on to say that Paratek has developed a rapid and highly sensitive COVID-19 test using its in-house technology and know-how in particle detection. Throughout this program, Paratek partnered with Professor Carl Smith and his team at the University of Sheffield to develop the proprietary microbiology technology that is required to operate the test with the hardware and software developed by Paratek. The collection of participant specimens for the COVID-19 clinical study at Sheffield Teaching Hospitals NHS Foundation Trust was successfully completed in March 2023. Paratek's COVID-19 test incorporates ParaSelect, which is trademarked separation technology, together with its CX300 instrument and software algorithms to identify SARS-CoV-2 virus particles in swab samples. The study compared the effectiveness of both Paratek's COVID-19 test and viral culture against the, quote, reference standard, unquote, which is quantitative PCR or qPCR, based detection of viral infection. The data has now been analyzed by the Statistical Services Unit at the University of Sheffield. The results successfully demonstrate the efficacy of Paratek's COVID-19 test. And there's a bit more detail which we can get to, but I just wanted to add that to what you were saying in terms of an update as to where this is. So as of March of 2023, this is still being developed and being touted as a success by Paratek. When you get into the technology here and the results, it's as ridiculous, if not more ridiculous, than what you and I and many others have talked about in the past. But again, I just wanted to add that more recent information to what you described.
Thank you, Jesse, because I have looked at their website before, and I have the link in my article, but I hadn't looked at it lately because I've been so focused on this whole part about, you know, the virus hasn't even been shown to exist rather than the test. So it's funny when you read that, I was almost laughing out loud because they're saying, COVID-19 test, which apparently it's some sort of optical test. It sounds like it might be some fairly novel sort of test, and viral culture, which we already know all about that. That's been torn to shreds over the last few years. And then they're saying, so they test Paratek's COVID-19 test and viral culture against the reference standard, which is quantitative PCR. So this is their gold standard. And this is what we're trying to show people. Like, there's no virus. They don't have a virus. Nobody's found the virus. No one's done any science to show that there's a virus. And they're treating PCR, which is just another indirect test for an imaginary virus. That's what they're treating as their gold standard. Like, this is hysterical. It's ludicrous. It's not funny because of the consequences, but I mean, if you just look at it on a surface level, it's so ludicrous. Like you said, it's hysterical. It's ridiculous how any so-called scientist in a university or a company that takes itself remotely seriously can be looking at of all the tests in the world for anything like PCR, that's your goal. Like, it's so ridiculous. This is just off the charts. So thank you for bringing that piece in.
Sure. And if we bring into the Corman-Drosten paper, the fallacious piece of information that is, the fallacious document that is, and understand that test has not been test, quote unquote, has not been validated in any way. No particle, as you put it, no starting point has ever been found to create a validation measure for that test. And it's been that way since the Euro surveillance paper back in early 2020. It's not like anything has improved or been enhanced or anything new has been found with regard to that. It's still as it was back then, essentially. If we understand that, then we can see that this is this new higher technology test, at least as it's advertised, is building off a fraud, using a fraud as its reference standard. So what does that say about this test itself in terms of its fraudulence? Well, if the foundation is a fraud, I think the logical conclusion is that this is a fraud. And that's not opinion. That is based on a very critical deconstruction and taking down of the Euro surveillance paper by the Corman-Drosten Review, especially, whom some of our colleagues were a part of. And PCR is, it's not garbage if it's used as it's supposed to be used, but in terms of detecting so-called viruses, it's utter garbage. But it remains as the reference standard for newer, again, I would say track and trace technologies that are being rolled out. And Carl Smith and the University of Sheffield with Paratech, so a public-private partnership, is at the forefront of this, at least in this case. So you had this run-in or came into contact with Carl Smith through asking the University of Sheffield for essentially proof of the SARS-CoV-2 quote-unquote virus particle that had been isolated. What were the requests you put in? And is that correct? Is that how Carl Smith came into your orbit?
Well, like I said, I don't remember exactly, but I suspect it was probably first on Twitter that I found out about him. And it might have also been because I have a colleague that once in a while asks me to send a Freedom of Information request to a certain institution because of people he's been, debating with on Twitter. So someone might have asked me to do it. I don't remember, but I did send the request back in March of 2021. And basically what happened was they gave me a ridiculous response, and they didn't even carry out the search. They didn't look for records. They refused my request. They claimed that, they told me that they have 5,000 researchers, 2,000 administrative people, 600 technicians, and that to perform the requests that I had asked for, that over 20 other universities have answered, no problem. They told me it would take 2,578 hours of work, and therefore they wouldn't do the request. And that was ridiculous. So then I said, okay, well, I narrowed down the request and I said, okay, please let me know any records that you have. And again, this is records by anyone in the world, just any records that these guys have downloaded that they, have on their computers or they've printed out. Doesn't have to be a study that they did themselves. Any record held by Carl, by the policymakers who were responsible for telling students that they can't come to school without an injection or a mask or whatever they were doing at the time. If I remember correctly, I think Sheffield was telling students they needed a jab, but I don't want to say 100% because that's going back a while. Or the president, the executive board, secretary, council, officers, vice chancellor, or faculties. So I basically listed off all the hot shots that are listed on their website. So I said, just focus on them, ask them if they have any records. So then the woman came back. Her name is Elspeth Summerfield. I'm just going to mention her name because these people are obfuscating and giving ridiculous responses. And the University of Sheffield has been just especially troublesome in this regard. Like, I've had many institutions, including universities, they just gave a response. So I've noted in the past that we seem to be reaching a new low with the University of Sheffield. So Elspeth Summerfield, who is acting as the Assistant Data Protection Officer in the University Secretary's Office, she said to me, okay, so your narrowed request, that will involve 130 people, and that will take between 21 and 43 hours of work. And so again, we're not going to do we're not doing it. We're not even going to search. So, excuse me. So I didn't get a response from the University of Sheffield, and I didn't bother publishing anything about this one. I could have added it to my list in the sense that, okay, I asked and they weren't cooperative. They didn't give me any records, but I just left it alone. I didn't say anything publicly about it. And I forgot all about the University of Sheffield and Carl Smith. And then fast forward to this year in March, 2 years later, I've completely forgotten about this request. And someone contacts me and says that Carl is bad-mouthing me on Twitter. And he's basically telling people that I tried to get his institute. Well, I'll read actually one of his tweets. So this is an example of the things he's been saying. So Ms. Massey tried to get my institution to declare it did not have any proven SARS-CoV-2 virus samples. Unfortunately for her, we do. Poor Christine. So first of all, Carl has misrepresented what I even asked for, because I didn't contact the university and say, do you have any proven SARS-CoV-2 virus samples? That's not my request. I'm asking, do you have any record of anyone in the world just doing that first step of finding and purifying? So he's misrepresenting what I asked for. And secondly, they didn't even do a search. And yet he, in this tweet and others, in other tweets, he was more explicitly telling people, I'm covering something up. I got a different sort of response from the University of Sheffield than I got from other institutions, but I'm not publishing it. So he was completely misleading people. And that's the only reason I started paying attention to the University of Sheffield again. I thought, oh, well, that can't be. And I went looking through my emails and my records, and I couldn't find any record of the interaction I'd had with the University of Sheffield. And I think because my Gmail keeps getting full and I have to delete a bunch of emails every once in a while. So I guess I deleted it by accident. So I filed another request to the university. I said, I want all the records that were between you and I before, so that I need a copy of the request and our communications. So I finally got it. I published it in May of this year. Excuse me. And I showed they didn't even do the search. I didn't cover anything up. There was nothing inappropriate. And yet Carl continued with his, you know, his comments on Twitter. So then I asked, so that's what got this back in my mind. So then I went back to the university and I went back to my original request about the virus. And I asked them, okay, can you do an even more narrowed request? Because she wouldn't do my other requests. So I said, okay, can you do the same thing, but just search to see if Carl is holding any records or the policymakers for the university? So it's much more narrow, but there'll be far fewer people involved. They shouldn't have make an excuse that they can't do this. So that's in June, I got the response from Elspeth. And what she did here was something new that I have never seen before. And this is what I referred to as a new low in the Freedom of Information responses. So she writes in her letter or her email, for clarity, purification refers to the processes in which biological substances are progressively enriched compared with the original source material. And this was very significant because it's not what I'm always very clear in my requests. I had used the word purification, and I had also made clear the separation of the virus, the alleged virus, from everything else in the patient sample. So if it's lung fluid,
Can I Can I quote your original request? So you requested all studies or reports describing the purification of, quote, SARS-CoV-2, unquote, aka, quote, COVID-19 virus, unquote, including any variants in inverted commas, via maceration, filtration, and use of an ultracentrifuge, where the patient sample was not first combined with any other source of genetic material, and records that describe its purification, separation from everything else in the patient sample, unquote. So that was your very clear request to the University of Sheffield.
Exactly. So I'm not just asking for a process where they were, you know, working on purifying gradually, progressively enriching, as they call it. I'm asking for records where you have an actual end result that they successfully separated the alleged virus from everything else in the patient sample. Now, before I go on with what else she said in her letter, I just want to clarify a couple things. One is that in that request, where I mentioned in brackets, saying purification via maceration, filtration, and ultracentrifugation, this is important. So I want to just touch on this for a moment. So the vast majority of my requests when I'm asking about virus purification, I didn't say that part. I didn't say via maceration. I didn't say any particular methods. But there was a phase for a short while with a series of institutions where I was saying that, I was specifying, because some people are saying, well, how do you do it? You know, I put it in some requests. Then I later decided it wasn't a good idea because it kind of limits the scope. It makes, when they come back and they say they have no records, well, it leaves a question mark in your mind. Well, maybe they have records where they're purified using different methods. So what I did with those requests where I had mentioned maceration, filtration, and ultracentrifugation, I went back to those institutions, I filed another request, and I said, by any method, purification by any method, and they still didn't have any records. So I just want to clarify that part. There could be one or two institutions where I didn't get around to going back, but I'm pretty sure I went back to all of them. So when I say I have 200 or 18 or 19 institutions from 40 countries on record, that's what it's for, like purification by any method. So I just want to be clear about that part. So that was one thing. There's something else I wanted to mention, but now it's slipped my mind. But so Elspeth has taken my request and she's basically reworking it on me. She's rewriting it without my authorization. It's my request. It's not her request. She doesn't get to project her idea of purification onto mine and say, oh, it's just a process where, you know, you're working on purifying something, but you don't necessarily achieve it. That's not what I asked for.
Right. And the language, if I can just add, is the opposite of what one would consider purification, because in purification, you're talking about stripping away everything but the particle itself. You're not talking about adding anything to it. And when you talk about when you say progressively or write progressively enriched, that what that reads to me is adding progressively more of whatever to the sample to ostensibly enrich it, whatever that means. And so you're getting farther away from purification, from the stripping down to the essential particle. So in her redefinition of this, not only is she projecting onto what you asked for and redefining what you asked for, but I think also giving away that their process or what they consider to be purification is the opposite of what purification is. It's about creating these stews that we talked about of other genetic material and all the rest to enrich whatever that means compared with the original source material. So it's, I see it as both a projection and maybe unwittingly an admission.
Well, you know, that was my initial reaction to Jesse. And I think, I mean, the first thing I thought when I read that was exactly what you're saying. It's, they're talking about cell culture nonsense, where you add the clinical sample to the monkey cells and the fetal bovine serum and the toxic drugs, and you're creating a more complex soup. And then I almost wrote that in my article, and then I thought, well, it's hard to say. You see, depending on what they did, I'm just going to give them the benefit of the doubt. Like, let's say that they did some filtration, they did some ultracentrifugation. If they were doing that, and this is all just assuming that there's a virus in there to even purify out, which is never, that's the whole point. Like, no one's ever demonstrated this. But even if in their minds that they think there's a virus and they're gradually eliminating some of the larger particles, I guess you might call that enrichment in the sense that you're increasing the percentage of what is left. More of it will be the virus because you're taking it. So it kind of like, but I know what you're saying, Jesse, and that was my reaction too. So I think that's probably what they've done. They've probably done the cell culture, but I don't know for sure. And this is the whole problem. As we'll get to, they didn't release the record. So she went on to say, that we have, I'm just going to scroll down and I'll read it a bit. She said, we can confirm that the university holds studies or reports within the scope you have outlined above. However, having considered your request carefully, we judge that the information is exempt from disclosure. So, and I can read more of what she said, but basically, she just got finished rewriting my request for me so that it's for something that I didn't actually ask for. And now she's saying, we can confirm what we do hold studies. Well, given that we know nobody else in the world has any records where they actually found and purified, and she's not going to release the records that she's claiming that they have, and she just rewrote my request for me, like, I'm pretty sure she's just talking about the usual nonsense. Probably cell culture, you know, but she's not going to release the records, so we don't get to look at them and critique them and respond. So, and also, I'm going to go back to what you're saying about progressive enrichment. I did reach out to, I was looking online too to see how that phrase gets used, and I also reached out to analytical chemist Saeed Qureshi. Saeed is someone I've been in touch with for a few years now. He was a senior scientist at Health Canada for over 30 years. I don't want to appeal to authority because we get that all the time in virology, you know, and we've realized, like, this is not complicated. It's not a complex topic. Anybody can learn and understand. It comes down to basic logic. But, you know, for anyone who, you know, I just want to let people know that I did talk to Saeed. He's an analytical chemist experienced in the lab. So for anyone that this gives them a measure of confidence in what I'm saying, this is what he said. And this is published in my article. So I'll just read a quote from Saeed. He said, progressive enrichment is, in fact, another name for what has been done all along. Culturing the swab sample and then treating it. And then he says in brackets, like mixing with stuff, and then comma, ultracentrifugation, which has been considered, in quotes, isolation, is now given a new name or label, progressive enrichment. They're using new terminology with the hope that you will not understand and will accept their view as authentic and scientific. So the analytical chemist is confirming what you and I can see, that Elspeth was just trying to, well, she's, I don't know if she's doing it knowingly or because she's, you know, someone who works in an office and possibly doesn't know very much about this topic. So whether she knows what she's talking about or someone put her up to this, she's bamboozling us with language. So, yes. Like I said, it was a new low, because usually usually institute, well, I've never had this exact type of response before where they try to redefine purification. And all this time, like in the beginning with the requests, I was using the word isolation, and I had to stop using that because then you get all these arguments about the word isolation. So then I moved to purification, and usually you're much safer with that word. But now we're finding that even if you use the word purify, these people are so determined to protect their little imaginary worlds that they're even playing around with that word now. So that was why I said it was a new low in responses. So, and then Elspeth goes on. Let's see, what else does she say? Just scrolling down here. So it got even more interest. Yeah, go ahead, Jess.
I think it's important to add, too, that as you write, she claimed that records are held by the university, but cited provisions of the legislation that exempt them from disclosure based on, one, an intention for future publication, and two, the fact that they were obtained in the course of or derived from a program of research. And as we know, this research is linked with the development of a commercial product. So there, at the very least, seems to be corporate interests involved here, or perhaps proprietary interests involved in not disclosing this information.
Yes, exactly. And Elspeth actually ended up spelling this out explicitly, which I was quite shocked that she did this. They have made some interesting admissions in this response and another one that I did more recently. So she goes on to say, in relation to your request, the studies or reports you requested form part of an ongoing research program between the University of Sheffield and Paritech Limited, led by Professor Smith of the University of Sheffield School of Biosciences, which will lead to future publication. We judge that disclosure of studies or reports at this point could allow for misinterpretation and manipulation of the research, with the potential for this to be used in support of pseudoscientific claims. So there's more, but I'll just stop there for a moment. So like you said, she came right out and admitted there's this, she didn't use the word commercial yet, but she does later, but she's pointing out this business relationship that exists with the university, with Carl, and with Paritech. And then it just gets pretty ridiculous because clearly she's been made aware that there's controversy and that the response that if they were to come out and give a straightforward response, that's going to cause some issues. Now, she calls the issues misinterpretation and manipulation. Well, I'm sorry, we don't have a way to manipulate his research. We're not there at the university, so that doesn't even make sense. But she's terming it as misinterpretation. If we show the public, look, either they admit they don't have any records or they go with this made-up definition of purification and they give us the records, we'll be able to read them, we'll be able to critique them, we'll be able to show everybody, look, this is what they're really doing. And just like all the other virology studies, it's ludicrous. So she's coming right out and admitting basically they have a political and commercial reason for not disclosing these records. That's basically what she's saying, and it becomes even more clear with as she goes on. And they're clearly aware that people are talking about this because she's saying it might be used in support of pseudoscientific claims. So they know that if they give a straightforward answer, we're going to call it pseudoscience, and they don't want that, so they're not releasing the records. So she goes on to say, we also judge that disclosure of the information would jeopardize the university's relationship with its commercial partners. So yeah, doesn't really get any more clear than that. She said it right for us. We don't even have to speculate. They're making their decision based on commerce, not on what's for the best of the people. And then she says, we judge that disclosure of the data at the current time would be likely to prejudice the peer review process. So this is really interesting because, apparently if they release the records and we read it and critique it and make it public, that might hurt the chances of getting their pseudoscience published. I mean, she's coming right out and saying it for us. And then she says, we recognize the public interest in the openness and transparency, and in ensuring that value for money is achieved and that commercial partnerships can be scrutinized. However, there's also a public interest in allowing the researchers to carry out their research and reach conclusions before the reports and studies are scrutinized externally. So, and then bottom line, we feel the greater public interest lies in allowing the research program to continue with its planned publication. Well, we're not asking them to halt publication. I mean, that would be wonderful, but that wasn't something that we asked for. We only asked, do you have records of actual purification? So they don't want to say no, but clearly that's the answer. They had to redefine purification so they could say, yes, we do have records, and then they won't let us read the records because then they know we'll point out how ridiculous they are.
Right.
So that's basically...
Yeah. And to say it another way again, first of all, you're only asking for the very starting point of this. Do you have this particle? That's the question. And they either can't or refuse to, or a combination of both, answer that. And then, as you point out in this article as well, we're talking about the development of technology that has been used and the development of new technology that will almost certainly be used to, it's already been used to lock down the world once. And there's no reason to disbelieve that that won't be tried again with these more sophisticated technologies that go beyond the scam of PCR and dazzle people with optic identification. And Carl Smith has made clear, he made clear in an interview he did back in 2021, which you embedded in this article, that this is about detecting so-called infections in large masses of people, which, again, when we understand that no virus has ever been proven to exist, no viral particle, so-called, has ever been isolated, purified, studied, we're talking about tracking and tracing technologies used to steer people, to monitor people's behavior, to control people, and maybe for agendas and projects beyond that that we're not fully aware of. So while it might seem confined in a sense what we're talking about here, it actually is part of a much larger picture that affects the entire world if we go by just the last 3+ years.
Absolutely. Yeah. And thank you for bringing that up, Jesse, because as always, yeah, it might seem like we're getting lost in these details that aren't that important. Why am I focusing on this? Why do we keep going on about this? But it all comes down to because immeasurable amounts of harm have been caused to the people, to not just people, but animals, pets, the food supply, the animals that get slaughtered. I mean, the amount of carnage in the name of virology and germ theory more generally, it's incalculable. And I really think most people they haven't stopped to think about just what a profound effect all of this has on life here on Earth. It's just, I can't even put it into words. So yeah, that's why we're doing that. And it might seem like, you know, so I'm just focusing on this one guy, but I'm just doing what I can do because the courts seem to be corrupt based on my experience and what I've seen of them. Like, I don't see much choice that way. So we're doing what we can do, and that's to educate the public. And I have focused on using freedom of information as a tool to help educate, to gather the evidence and help show people. So that's what it's all about. It comes down to just wanting to educate people so that they don't fall victim and that we can all try to bring about a course correction in our world. so that these things don't keep happening over and over and over again. And thank you for also mentioning the fact that his test, it says, yes, and I think it's quoted on my site, that it's what they call a multiplex test, where they, like you said, they can actually somehow test, do a bogus test on large numbers of people all at once, which is even more alarming and even more ridiculous.
Yes, and getting back to the Paratek website and the description of the test, it reads the detailed results. And so these are the results that supposedly demonstrate the efficacy of Paratek's COVID-19 test. The detailed results were reported to Paratek as follows. In a sample of 116 patients recruited within 4 days of symptom onset, and I had a long conversation on this program with our colleague Mike Stone about the so-called symptomology of so-called COVID-19. So there's that to keep in mind. But in a sample of 116 participants recruited within 4 days of symptom onset, the Paratek test correctly identified 92.8% of all SARS-CoV-2 positive cases. This rose to 100% in participants with a relatively low viral load. The Paratek test also correctly identified 89.2% of participants who did not have a SARS-CoV-2 infection. So this is what they're claiming. We know what it's actually detecting. I can't say. I don't know if the developers can even say, but it's most likely some iteration of genetic material that is present in all of us. And this stems all the way back to the Fan Wu paper and the fraud that was carried out there in inventing a genome for a particle that was never isolated or shown to exist, and how built into that was this cascading effect of, well, you use this as a primer in a test, and it's something that's common to most, if not everybody in the world, then even factoring in the margins of error with the tests, you're going to find this in most people and create the illusion that there is a new and novel pathogen going around supposedly infecting people and making them sick. So the numbers here are, I think, speak for themselves in terms of how ridiculous they are, especially rising to 100% in participants with a relatively low viral load. We've talked a bit in the past about viral loads and how there's not enough in, or how virologists claims there aren't enough virus particles in samples that are taken to be able to isolate them properly. And yet here we have, with a relatively low viral load, claims that this test is 100% spot on in identifying people who are said to be sick with, or said to have SARS-CoV-2 within 4 days of symptom onset. All of which is to say that there are a bevy of assumptions and falsehoods and pseudoscience built into this. But again, this is new and novel technology that is meant to be used for tracking and tracing under the guise of public health. And it's very dangerous, as we've seen over the last 3+ years. And this needs to be homed in on and called out.
Yeah. And based on what we read earlier about how they're using PCR as the gold standard, and we know that PCR gets used in calculating these so-called viral loads. It sounds like that's exactly what they're doing. And yeah, exactly. It's more of this surveillance, convincing people they're sick, convincing people, oh, you need to stay away from other people. You need to do this. You need to do that. Take these toxic medications, on and on and on. And I'll have to go back and read again what you're saying, but it sounds like they were looking at people who were sick, and then they're testing them in the first 4 days of symptom onset. And then they're just looking at a correlation between two bogus tests. They have their PCR and then some other tests that what his optical, whatever the heck they're doing. You're looking at a correlation between two meaningless tests that have not been validated against a proper gold standard. So it's all just, like you said before, it's just fraud, build on top of fraud or dilute. I'm not talking legally. I don't know if these people know that they're trapped in a world of delusion and imaginary particles, but they're either delusional or they're purposely, involved in fraud. But either way, I would call it scientific fraud, because they're clearly not using the scientific method. They don't even have a valid independent variable. And yeah, to pretend that science is just incorrect.
There are some more. There's a quote or several quotes from Carl Smith himself, which are just as ridiculous, if not even more ridiculous, which I'll leave to listeners to look up. Although I'll read a segment here. Importantly, unlike PCR, which detects small so-called, quote, dead, unquote, fragments of viruses present both before and long after the infectious phase, the Paratek test detects intact viral particles, which are more likely to indicate the presence of infectious virus. The Paratek test was substantially better at detecting the presence of viral particles than viral culture, a labor-intensive approach which requires up to 7 days of incubation, which yielded positive results in only about 30% of the samples. And he goes on to say that one of the benefits of this test and its technology is that it will abrogate the need for sophisticated and expensive centralized laboratory-based PCR testing. So we're talking about decentralized, quote-unquote, testing here with new and novel technology that has dubious validation, if any validation at all. But again, this can all be read on paratek.com/COVID-19-test. And just to finish up in the last two or so minutes that we have, Christine, it seems like you did continue to follow up on this, and you've been stonewalled and unsurprisingly told that your FOI requests are vexatious.
Correct. And I'm no longer welcome to file any COVID-19 related FOI requests with the University of Sheffield. They won't be responding to any of them. Even though I had filed a new request, it was unique. It was different from this request. And yes, they said I was being, they used the word vexatious. And yeah, that's in my most recent Substack article, and people can go and read about it there. So basically, the circus continues at the University of Sheffield, and my next step will be to file a complaint. Not that I have 100% faith or anything in these commissioners, but it's worth a try. Because if we could get the record, then it would be really nice to be able to read and just show everybody what is actually going on in this research of Carl's and Paratek's.
Yes, and vexatious, I'll add, is it's an official term, so to speak, in that, as you point out in your second article, which is titled University of Sheffield Protects Fake COVID Test Developers, Paratek Limited and Carl Smith, again, in the official literature of the legislation for FOI requests in the UK, if something is deemed vexatious in that it can disrupt or unsettle projects or people involved in those projects, then it can be considered vexatious, and therefore it doesn't have to be fulfilled, because it's another way of essentially saying, well, this requires a lot of work on our part, and it could reveal things that we don't want to be revealed for whatever reasons. And so therefore it's vexatious to us. That's the official term they use, and we're not going to do it. But yeah, just to finish up. Yes, go ahead.
It's just your fancy way of saying they don't want to respond. It's not in their interest to respond.
Yes, yes.
That's all.
So Christine, thank you for all the work you do in this capacity with the FOIs, and thank you for sticking to this one. I think these technologies are something we need to keep a focus on, because they're not just going to be used for so-called viruses in the future. They're going to be used for many other tracking and tracing purposes, and none of which I can see as good for humanity. So thank you for shining a spotlight on this, and thank you for joining me today to go through this. Very much appreciated.
Thank you, Jesse. It's always a pleasure.
Absolutely. And that's it for me. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Steve Hook is up next here on TNT Radio. Take care.